from such accounts, we can see how incredibly emotional and how incredibly pleasurable it could be on the social level, not only for the people involved, but for the whole group. And we can really see how violence on others becomes the core of social identity, of the national identity. We tend to think about violence, about committing violence as antisocial and the eros that is the only force that brings us together. But we can see here how eroticized violence or sexualized violence may do it as well. And I think that after so many years of research, we don't really have to ask the question, how is it that people can do such things, or how can people become murderers on a social level, on a group level? But I'd say the more interesting question we may ask is, how did the murderers stay people and stay citizens? And how could, after committing such crimes in plain sight of the whole group, how could the group remain a stable group? And how could a community of murderers and bystanders to the violence, what is the social glue that brings them all together? And I would say that the eroticized violence is one of the main aspects, where one of the main elements of creating a closed identity based on denial of humanity of the other.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast consists of conversations with psychoanalysts from around the world who share with us their clinical and psychoanalytic work with individuals both on and off the couch. And what we mean by off the couch is that they share with us their community involvement in many different venues apart from their consultation rooms. They describe their work in hospitals, in community clinics, in refugee centers, in classrooms, indeed in war zones. We also have conversations with psychoanalysts who are focusing their work on the couch, and they are continuing to refine both our familiar and novel understandings of the dynamic mind as it presents itself in the analytic situation. We've been talking to elders in our field, people who've been practicing for 50 plus years, and they share with us how they view this field evolving and where they see it going. We also talk to clinicians who had professions prior to becoming psychoanalysts, and they share with us their journeys to doing what they now love. These are just samplings of the psychoanalysts we've been talking with, again, from all corners of the globe. Please visit our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can subscribe, where you can see the recommended readings provided by our guests, and you can also leave a comment. I hope you enjoy these conversations and find them thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Jan Borowicz. Jan Borowicz is a candidate in psychoanalytic training at the Polish Psychoanalytic Society, and he is a certified psychotherapist. Our conversation today is on his recently released book entitled Perverse Memory and the Holocaust, A Psychoanalytic Understanding of Polish Bystanders. And it's really a very deep study of what bystanding means. And he distinguishes bystanding from witnessing. And we talk about what the differences are and how witnessing is often something we do clinically in the office. Bystanding is something else entirely. He talks about eroticized excitement over violence, talks about denial, and the concept of perversion, which he feels best captures what the experience of bystanding is. And he details this, focusing on the Polish Holocaust and the many non-Jewish Poles who both participated in and also were bystanders in, at times, everyday horrors that we will discuss. As one might imagine, we also discuss the difficulty of discussing this material and what it's like to listen to it and what it was like for him to do the research in it. And he shared how he managed this over his many years. And I close with really being grateful to him for doing this work and for challenging the denial that we all have, certainly people in his country, he says, have, and inviting us to reconsider this in the spirit of hopefully allowing mourning to take place as opposed to perverse denial. I hope you find this as important a conversation as I did. Here is my talk with Jan Borovitch. Jan, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Your work is an effort to help us understand, through a psychoanalytic lens, the phenomena of bystanding in the presence of extreme violence. The two most notorious example of this from the last century were the Rwandan genocide and the Polish Holocaust. There, neighbors slaughtered long-standing neighbors under the watchful and excited gaze of neighbors. You have meticulously studied this latter example, where non-Jewish Poles both participated in and stood by while their Jewish Polish neighbors were massacred. And you propose a model of perversion, as understood psychoanalytically, and we're going to spend some time on that, to enable us to try to make sense of this. And this effort is important for us today because, as we know, the 1994 Rwandan genocide was not the last example of bystanding. Bystanding informs all of our lives today. And I want to start us off with the title of your paper. And I want to read that because it's so evocative, so much so that I borrowed it for the title of our podcast. And from there, I want to go to read from the last page of your book. You quote, and I'll ask you to explain where this quote is from and to flesh it out for us. You quote and you say, "We need to forget about what we actually did not even see here." I'll repeat it because it's intentionally mind-bending. "We need to forget about what we actually did not even see here." And on the last page of the book, you write, "Psychoanalysis assumes the following possibility. Memories and feelings can return under favorable conditions. For example, after successfully working through grief, we may feel sad about the loss. In the case of perverse memory, what operates is not repression, but denial. I deny because I cannot forget. In the case of denial, we perfectly remember what happened, but we simultaneously act as if we know nothing. The other side of complete denial is thus complete surprise." Jan, you want to start us off?
All right. Thank you for talking with me. I borrowed the title, and this is indeed a wonderful phrase from a movie by Marcin Wrona. Its title is Demon. It is available for watching, and it's a it's a very good movie about a social crisis that that erupts when the community, when the ethnic Polish community wants to celebrate a wedding in a house that was owned previously by the Jewish neighbors. And it is not said how it changed how it changed into a Polish house, and on the day of the and of and the day on the day and night of the wedding, a demon, Dybuk, gets into the mind and the body of the groom, and tries to get back what she, because actually the book is a woman, what she wants and what she previously possessed. And this is a phrase that comes near the end of the movie. One of the characters says to everybody, "Yes, we did not see anything in here. Plus, let's forget about it." And this is a wonderful phrase, very dense and very unconscious a phrase that I'd say captures exactly what I want to say about. The perverse memory, and about the main mechanism that operates within perverse memory, which is denial.
Let me ask you, because I think many people may feel as I did, your description in the book of this wedding that took place in a home that used to belong to Jews and who, quote, disappeared, and come back to... infect the celebration, leading to all kinds of calamities, and it's ended by everything disappearing. You describe it very beautifully in the book, and the title of the movie is what?
Demon.
Demon, and it's the kind of thing one could find on Netflix?
I think it's on Apple TV.
Apple TV, and I trust it has subtitles?
Yes.
Yes, okay, yeah. It's on my list. It's at least based on your description, it's really quite something.
No, it's a pretty recent movie, and it is the main problem with this movie is that it is absolutely it is very hard to say how it ends and on what note and what are we left with after the movie, and this is also captured by this sentence that that denial, and this is what I argue in the book, generates two distinct worlds. Two distinct phenomena. Well, to say it precisely in psychoanalytical terms, it produces splitting between seeing and unseeing, between knowledge and lack of knowledge, between awareness and oblivion, and they simultaneously. Well, they are created simultaneously, and this is. How we deal with unwanted or troubling knowledge, and this is something completely different than the mechanism of repression. And we usually think about the Holocaust, about our social dealing with loss or with mass atrocities or mass violence through the framework of repression. And I think that in case of, for example, how did Polish or ethnically Polish bystanders dealt with the burden, with the trauma of Holocaust, is through denial and through perverse mechanisms rather than repression.
The way you characterize it in this terrific phrase, you say it's one eye open and one eye closed, which really captures it. You also mention the Polish experience, and your background, which we will talk about later, is as a cultural historian, which is a vital perspective in psychoanalysis. And you have made the point that the Holocaust was obviously experienced differently, but also therefore understood differently by those from Western Europe, not to mention the States, and those in Eastern Europe. And I think that is a thread that runs through much of your work, And we will get to that as well. I do want to draw our attention to your use of the term perversion, because, of course, it has very specific psychoanalytic meaning. And to read a quote from the book, you write, "In psychoanalytic categories, we may also describe such representations as perverse, because the extreme violence they involve becomes saturated with pleasure. Instead of pain, horror, sadness, and loss, there appears a fleeting yet barely noticeable smile. In everyday language, perversion means something excessive and deceitful, something that betrays a pathological transgression of social and ethical norms. However, you write that in the book, you use the notion of perversion as separate from value judgment, which is, as you say, an elementary approach in psychoanalysis. Now, share with us what led you to connect these two, the bystanding in the face of extreme violence and perversion.
Well, I have a story to tell. Tell it in the book in the beginning of the book as well. But this is a true story. That whilst visiting the museum on site of Bełżec extermination camp, one of the main extermination camps in on Polish territory. On the exhibition, there was one photo that actually my friend, my colleague, spotted, which was a typical occupational photo from the occupation, from the violence that was perpetuated by German soldiers on the Jews. There was a soldier cutting off the beard of a Jewish man, and it was just a photo that was supposed to represent the atrocities that German army dealt to the Jews. And my colleague spotted something on the background of this photo. And just like 10 meters or 20 meters away from the scene, in the background, stood a couple or three persons, three women, actually. And we may assume that they are local women because they are neither soldiers nor Jews, and they are dressed typically as a peasant woman, maybe Polish, maybe Ukrainian, we don't know. And even after my archival work, I couldn't find out who these women could be. And one woman appears to be smiling, and this was absolutely, well, shocking experience. Is it really possible that a woman could smile in face of such atrocities? And I was really in shock, and also very troubled with this photo. Also, perhaps I was thinking to myself, maybe it's an over interpretation. Maybe this is a blurred photo. This is a photo from 1940s. So the cameras were not technically advanced as they are today. But yet I thought that it is a point of departure to state a question, to pose a question: is it possible to really feel pleasure and really to be satisfied with seeing and bystanding a scene of violence, and to just to be next to it, just to be at arm's length beside beside a horrible event, a horrible violence that is going on, and yet taking some pleasure of it. Well, there's the the German word for it that you probably know. This is Schadenfreude. Is the pleasure that stems from seeing someone else's pain. And this is like my main question: how is it possible? Furthermore, how it can be remembered, how it can be integrated into social memory and social identity afterwards. Because this is one thing to experience it, and the other thing is how does this experience change the whole internal world of a social group.
When I was visiting Poland not that long ago, the guide was sharing with me and my conversation with Polish analysts subsequently informed me, which your work corroborates, that there is a sense of living with ghosts in Poland, which is sort of like the movie you mentioned. There's a Dybbuk that returns, a ghost that haunts everybody, and we're going to talk more about that in a minute. The photograph, which is the one photograph in your book, and it's in the first page, the introduction, which really, as you say, frames the work. There is the atrocity being committed, and there are the bystanders who are smiling in the background. And your effort is to help us understand that phenomena. You challenge the idea that bystanding has a relation to indifference. You claim otherwise, and I'm going to ask you to read again a paragraph from your book that addresses this issue of bystanding and indifference and pleasure.
In psychoanalytical terms, the violence experienced and even viewed from a distance does not cause indifference, as it is often written about the attitude of ethnic Polish bystanders, but rather a mixture of fearful identification and repressed sadistic pleasure of triumph. The one figure of the possible perversity of the bystander's position may be the account cited by Lawrence L. Langer about a Hungarian Jesuit, Father S., who secretly observes through a hole in a wooden fence the scene at the station of Jews' transportation to Auschwitz. When an SS man torments a prisoner, the monk escapes. During his testimony for the Fortunov video archives for Holocaust testimonies at Yale University, the Jesuit spoke about that event for the very first time. The psychoanalyst present during the filming comments that it was not the event itself that was repressed, but the voyeuristic pleasure of watching someone else's suffering, namely the situation of being sucked through that knothole and being in the middle of the scene of violence. It seems that this is the essence of the repeated question about the visibility and invisibility of the Holocaust, and whether the Polish and other Eastern European societies could have known about it. The violent deportations and later massacres, mass shootings, death camps, were at arm's length, sometimes only slightly obscured by a fence. Sławoj Žižek describes it in terms of a dirty secret, by comparison to the dirty secret of Freudian hysterics, who conceal the fact that their symptoms are of a sexual nature. Nazis themselves, and this is Žižek talking, Nazis themselves treated the Holocaust as a kind of collective dirty secret.
Now, if I follow your thinking here, you're saying that the... Are you saying that the illicit pleasure in viewing the pain of others, that is repressed, because that's what you sort of say in analogizing it to hysterics, but that the doing of it is under denial? Help me unpack that.
Well, this is a good example, I would say, about splitting that occurs, mm-hmm. the splitting between, with the natural fact that in order to see through a hole, one must close one eye, and this is the splitting between what mm-hmm. you see, what you can see, and what you cannot see, and this occurs at the very same time. It occurs simultaneously, and this particular occurrence, and it has to be said that the father S escaped from the scene, as he was too afraid of what he was seeing, and the interpretation of the of Lawrence Langer tells us, he was also too afraid of his own excitation. And I think that it also gives a good it makes a point of the visibility of the Holocaust and really the difference what you said earlier between the Eastern and Western experience of the Holocaust, which in the Eastern Europe really was at arm's length. So it was not only in what is like the main figure of the imagination of the Holocaust, that the killing actually occurred in gas chambers, in sites that they were distant, they were taken out of the normal living space. It actually in the Eastern Europe occurred everywhere, occurred in absolute vicinity of the local population, which could observe it directly. On the Western,
When I learned that, I was quite surprised, being Westernly oriented. The picture I had was that the Holocaust was by definition related to the concentration camps and the death camps. And then I discovered, as you just said, that the majority of murders took place much closer at hand in the East, and also often with regular German troops, not special troops. And also with, like you're writing, neighbors upon neighbors. The majority did not take place in the death camps. And that's and that reorients anyone trying to study and understand this.
As horrible as it may seem, I think that our theory of, or our, well, general or popular understanding of the Holocaust as, well, this remote, rational, non-emotional practice that was focused only on in the concentration camps, in the extermination camps, is slightly is it also a defense mechanism, or it's paints an sort of obsessive compulsive image of the Holocaust as if it was not at all emotional. And I think that what we know and what we what we discover with countless testimonies and with the of the experience of the people committing the crimes, but also of the people observing the crimes, that paints a different picture, of experiencing not only the loss or the absence of the Jews, of the neighbors, but also the abundance or too muchness of images, of feelings, of stories, that, well, if it all happened in here among the neighbors, among the bystanders, have to deal not with the void, not with the lack, but too muchness of this historical experience. And this is something that especially when combined with anti-Semitism that was pervasive in the Eastern Europe, when it combines with anti-Semitism and direct benefits from the Holocaust, economical, social, and emotional as well, then it gives something much more difficult, I'd say, to remember. For remembering for the next generations and for the people that live where the Holocaust happened.
There's a thread that runs through your book that isn't as widely appreciated as it might be, which is the material advantages that accrued to the bystanders when they murdered their neighbors. As you point out in many examples, the phrase you use, while the bodies were still warm, they would come into their homes and either sit down and have their meals or appropriate their jewels, their clothing, their apartments themselves, etc. I think you say in the book somewhere that the Polish middle class was built upon the stolen Jewish property. You talk about things being close up in Eastern Europe. And if we're to talk about bystanders, one needs to also talk about theatricality. Bystanders look at things, and things are performed often for the benefit of the bystanders, which leads me to read a difficult account from your book, but it sort of makes this point of yours. You write, "One may recall one of many accounts of the theatricality of the atrocities characteristic for the Holocaust taking place in Central and Eastern Europe. As evidence, for example, in Lithuania, where the Jews were clubbed to death with crowbars before cheering crowds, mothers holding up their children to see the fun, and German soldiers clustered around like spectators at a football match. At the end, while the streets ran with blood, the chief murderer stood on the pile of corpses as a triumphant hero and played the Lithuanian national anthem on an accordion. Not only does the mass murder happen in plain sight, but it is accompanied by the festive atmosphere and is incorporated in kitschy ethno-nationalistic narrative. The atrocities are carried out in the name of perversely understood justice, but also provide extreme amounts of frantic excitement."
Yes, this is also where I see the denial in our contemporary memory, that that the major idea is that the ethnically Polish bystanders were indifferent or like emotionally indifferent, and I think that really psychoanalysis gives us a perspective to think about it and to claim that ultimately emotional indifference is impossible. And this is a very simple thesis, yet I say profound in its implications, that of course one can detach or dissociate or negate the emotional significance of seeing atrocities in this theatrical manner, but it would be an active process, or it would be an active decision to claim afterwards that we were indifferent. And from such accounts, we can see how incredibly emotional and how incredibly pleasurable it could be. It could be on the social level, not only for the people involved, but for the whole group, and we can really see that how violence on others becomes the core of social identity, of the national identity. We tend to think about violence and about committing violence as antisocial, and the eros that is the only force that brings us together, but we can see here how eroticized violence or sexualized violence may do it as well. And the I think that after so many years of research, we don't really have to ask the question, how is it that people can do such things, or how can people become murderers on a social level, on a group level? But I'd say the more interesting question we may ask is, how did the murderers stay people and stay citizens, and how could, after committing such crimes in plain sight of the whole group, how could the group remain a stable group, and how could a community of murderers or and bystanders to the violence, what is the social glue that brings them all together? And I would say that the eroticized violence is one of the main aspects, where one of the main element of creating a closed identity based on denial of humanity of the other, of the so-called other. And since the Middle Ages, especially in the Eastern Europe, the Jews were the most significant other. Became the most significant other. In other words, I am not an ethnic, I am an ethnic Pole, or I'm an ethnic Lithuanian, because I'm not a Jew.
I sort of don't know how to comment to that. I'm just going to let that stand. It was so beautifully and movingly put. Let me ask you to read the next quote. Again, it's about bystanders and how they are or aren't implicated.
Gazing, looking, gapping, peeping is an active process. Irrespectively of the level of the complicity in the atrocities, the bystanders were implicated in various types of onlooking. Witnessing victims being taken away, deportations, mass killings, dead bodies, fresh graves. Even without actively taking part in the crime, implication varies. From seeing the violence only indirectly through seeing the atrocities themselves, to being requisitioned by the perpetrators, as for example, the owners of tools necessary to commit atrocities, and not in the possession of troops. However, one Polish artist staged the Jedwabne pogrom, perpetrated by the ethnic Polish neighbors, and recreated the festive atmosphere in which looking at the atrocities became a captivating, exciting event. Picnics and fairs are not at all passive. They fit in the dialectics of pleasure and boredom, anticipation and ecstasy. The deconstruction of the paradigm of ethnic Poles' passivity during the Holocaust should not stem from the opposition of looking and acting, but from a reflection on what type of gaze dominates. Historians have already deconstructed the wishful idea that only looking at the mass killings of the Jews was no action. On a mostly concrete level, it prevented the possibility of escape for the victims. On the more symbolic level, it created a theatrical situation with the scene of atrocity and the involved spectators. In time of mass atrocities, there is little distance between playful torment and active violence. What we unfortunately learn from these accounts is the fact that people love to observe violence, and even if they do not actively participate in it, and love to observe violence and identify with various actors. And especially when the other that suffers is a previously disliked neighbor. And it is also very important to note that these are neighbors, that for the vast majority of Jews living in rural communities in the Eastern Europe, they are simply neighbors with their Gentile, with the Gentile local population. And in this sense, they are not really that different. They are a little different in their rituals, in the religion, in language, but this is a violence between, usually between people that really know each other. And well, Freud called it the narcissism of little differences, and this is, I think, an idea that we shouldn't forget, that this, that social violence, as identity building, is not directed at somebody completely different or an other that we see nothing in common with. It usually deals with the other that is really close. And what you said earlier about about the middle class that that took that benefited from the Holocaust. This is what is researched in Polish historiography recently, and one of the philosophers called the Holocaust an overslept revolution, overslept or dreamed revolution, and in two meanings, in two psychoanalytical meanings. First of all, treating the dream as a fulfillment of a wish, that the Holocaust for the culture, for the ethnically Polish culture, which was vastly anti-Semitic, the Holocaust perpetrated by somebody else, by the Germans, was a fulfillment of a wish. And overslept revolution in the other sense, that it gave a chance to the ethnically Polish bystanders of staying passive, and therefore to treat what the bystanders were observing as if they were not there. And this brings me back to the quote from the movie, that that it is possible to see something, to observe something, and then to remember it as if you were not there, or that you want to forget something that you think that you didn't actually see.
Jan, you have a chapter in your book, and it's called Sadism, Drastic Returns of the Dead, where you describe the phenomena that I was familiar with years ago when I used to work with Vietnam veterans, and they feared the return of the people they killed. And you describe in your book, in reference to the Warsaw Ghetto, you have a quote in the subtitle. It says, "We will not forgive you for what we did to you." It's another one of those sentences like the title, "We will not forgive you for what we did to you." And you write in the first sentence of that chapter, "There's a particular post-traumatic phenomena. The hatred that perpetrators ascribe to their victims while retaining the conviction of their own innocence. Cruelty and vengefulness shift and roles reversed. The perpetrator becomes the victim, and the victim becomes the perpetrator. The more harm is done, the more despicable become the harmed.
This is an ancient Roman thought, so we may assume that this is a human phenomenon, that we hate the people that we victimize. In this sense, to describe the memory of what happened to the Jews that were actually coming back, that survived the Holocaust and tried to rebuild their lives after the Second World War and after the Holocaust, and how for them it was so dangerous that most of them escaped just after the end of the war, then 10 years later, and then almost entirely 20 years after the war. It was dangerous for many reasons, and anti-Semitism or prevalence of anti-Semitism was one of them, but also the danger was the property that was left to the Gentile neighbors or just left so the people felt that they could take it, since it belonged to nobody. And to be able to take somebody else's property, what is needed is the denial of the humanity of the victim, of the previous owner. And I would argue that it comes with the price, with psychic price, which resurfaces when the victims come back. And the price is what I think is really captured in some of the representations of the Holocaust that use the horror genre, use the horror of vengeful ghosts or zombies or the dead who come back and seem cruel, seem vengeful, and seem to harm the people that usually think of themselves as innocent, as people who were just observing the violence, did not actively participate in it. And there are countless testimonies of these feelings, that if I'm not going to take it, somebody else will, or the German soldier will take it, so it's better than I will take it. But the horrors, or even sometimes the stories about the ghosts coming back in the right now in towns or in cities where the ghettos were, proves that taking somebody else's or benefiting from the death of the other results, and I would argue, with unconscious paranoid fear or paranoid guilt that may be silenced when nobody is asking questions or nobody is coming back, but really may quickly resurface after somebody is asking a question, and this is my own experience of research or coming to the old Jewish shtetls, and just by asking a question, what was here before the war, because we know it, and we know that it's everywhere like this, that people really know what who were the previous owners. And you may encounter a very aggressive reaction just by asking this question.
We're going to get in a moment to what your experience has been doing this research. But speaking of reactions, I have a reaction to our having this conversation now. And I say that having read your book very carefully and am more or less familiar with this literature. I'm finding it difficult to stay present. It's not for lack of anything you're saying or doing. I'm finding the subject matter to be a source of difficulty, and I'm find myself losing focus, and I just want to put that out there. Mm. Notably, you make speaking to what I just said, you make an important distinction that is sort of, I think, for me, the remedy, and maybe for many, the remedy for this is when you make the important distinction between bystanding and witnessing. And I'd like to read a paragraph where you address that very beautifully. You write, "Ethnic Poles, for the most part, failed in assuming the role of empathic witness, alive thirds, whose existence in the case of catastrophes and traumas, as psychoanalyst Samuel Gerson wrote, we hoped for." He wrote, "We hope first that there is an engaged witness, an other that stands beside the event in the self and who cares to listen. An other who is in a position to confirm both our external and our psychic realities, and thereby to help us integrate and live within all realms of our experience. This is the presence that lives in the gap, absorbs absence, and transforms our relation to loss." And you write, "This living third is the witness, while the dead third is the lost object, on whom one relied, trusted, and through a relationship with them had a sense of continuity and meaning. However, when bystanders are too absorbed in their own affairs, when trauma victims are denied recognition of their suffering, the victims feel that the world is not a place where they can rely on anything, is not operating according to fixed and predictable rules." Flesh out for us, if you will, the distinction between witnessing and bystanding, because as humans, and even more so as clinicians and analysts, we are often called upon to witness trauma in our office, and at times witnessing, being affectively open to the experience without necessarily reflection and comment, but being open to it, is a part of, an essential part of what we do. And that obviously is very different, as you point out, from bystanding. So want to help us with that.
Well, coming back to what you said about the difficulty of focusing or concentrating on it, I think this is a very important point, that dealing with such representations, dealing with the memories of the mass violence or the Holocaust as a paradigm for violence on such a scale, it is very difficult to be emotionally open to it and to all of its implications. And I'd say that I try to be as empathic as I can, but this is a challenge to metabolize it. And I think that that there is a temptation, and there is a, well, to dissociate from it, or just to not think about it. And this is, well, we all have to defend ourselves somehow. There is also another path that I think that is pervasive in especially among historians, which is facing the failure, for example, for being empathic, for being emotionally opened, for truly witnessing. So giving space for the victims to tell about their experience, to see one's own involvement in what happened to the victims. Facing that, many historians or some historians, I'd say, fall into another trap. Of rage, and of somehow oppositional emotional stance, and to see and to search for another accounts, for another for another stories about. For example, ethnic Poles as failed witnesses, or the bystanders who only dehumanize or abuse the memory and of the victims, and this is another emotional attitude, I think that we all share in face of violence on such a large scale. But coming back to your question, I think that thinking about the bystanders and thinking whether they could become witnesses who are emotionally attuned with the with the suffering of victims is very important, as we now see the trauma, and I think that it is somehow sometimes forgotten about it, that the trauma involves not only the perpetrator and the victim, but also the third party that was nearby, and if it's a traumatic experience, then this third party usually stood and did nothing, or worse, they somehow participated in it through observing, through peeping, through benefits, or just observing it with a barely noticeable smile. And for victims, this is a devastating experience, because it gives the experience of somehow of a double dehumanization, both by the perpetrators and the bystanders alike.
And that is something on a much more a small scale and an individual level. Those of us who work with people who have suffered childhood trauma, there is the same. There is, if you will, the parent who commits the sadistic act, and then there's the indifferent, observing, or even encouraging other parent, to use one example. And yes, that is it is more devastating. Let me ask you something, Jan. Again, for me to read this and for us to have this conversation takes a toll, maybe a little too dramatic, but has a gravitas to it, certainly. You've spent, I think you told me, 5 years researching this book, and it's an outgrowth of your PhD dissertation. Tell us about you. How did you make your way through this, and what drew you to it, first of all, but also what was it like for you?
Well, this is of course how we touched upon it a little bit a second before. This takes a toll, and this is sometimes very difficult to metabolize, or or just to put it simpler, just to live every day or day by day, reading, watching movies, spending time in the archives, researching, and to be in not so distant past, but certainly violent and gruesome past, and somehow to remind oneself that well, now is now, and there's a whole world that is taking place right now, and I after such time, I have to say that I feel at home in the archives and reading about it, and it's the past, and I see the connections of the past to the right now, and lately or recently, I had then amongst so many wars, conflicts, humanitarian crisis that, well, we are all reading about or we are experiencing it, and I like one day I somehow recognized in myself a thought that in which I asked myself, how is it all possible? How can people be so cruel towards each other? How is it possible? And then I was honestly and genuinely really struck about the stupidity of this thought, or the silliness of this idea, as if I was not dealing with it, reading, researching, watching movies almost every day, and then I realized that this is exactly the denial. This is exactly the mechanism on disconnecting something that I think I knew with the emotional experience of it. And I remember Australian psychoanalyst Neville Symington saying in one of the lectures that there exists a tiny dissociated part in every psychoanalyst that, and this was an idea that really struck me, a tiny part that does not believe in psychoanalysis and it does not believe in the idea that talking to other people really can change anything or help anybody. And maybe there's this part that in me as well, that simply does not believe that it all happened, because, well, as you said, or I think you said, it is sometimes incredibly painful, or too painful and unbearable to be constantly emotionally opened, and to be aware that this could and in fact did happen.
You said earlier, Jan, that when you go back to the communities that used to contain Jews and you would talk to people, you were met with anger often. And you said that it was, if we are silent, the guilt is not allowed to be. It's bypassed. And so nothing is mourned. And when you said that, I thought, how important, how noble is the work you do? Because you are awakening, yes, certainly in the actual bystanders who still live, and the bystanders around the world who still are present, but also in all of us, because this is, I mean, there's bystanding and there's bystanding. I get that. But we all can relate to what you're pointing out in others in some form or another. And so you do a good deed. You do a service for us, a painful one at times, in how meticulously you have immersed yourself in this work and how carefully and thoughtfully you have shared with us your understanding, which I'm sure enriches your clinical work as a psychoanalyst to be as well. And so there is more good things to come from your thoughtfulness and your dedication. And I want to thank you. Thank you for your work and for our getting a chance to speak to each other and to share your thoughts with all of our listeners. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much as well. And I'm moved by talking to you, and I feel that really you were emotionally and intellectually present, and I'm very grateful for that as well.
Thanks again.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.